This year, our podcast will explore the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past. And will also put into context how the sense of heritage is all about our collective experience and why so much that went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. Each year, the Heritage Council awards the Heritage Hero Award to an individual or organisation that has demonstrated an outstanding contribution to the protection and promotion of heritage in Ireland. In today's podcast, I chat with Patrick Bonner from Burtonport, County Donegal, who is the winner of the Heritage Hero Award 2021. Patrick has been involved with local heritage projects in Western Donegal for over 20 years, and has been involved with many projects in Burtonport and the Rosses. His work, his curiosity, his enthusiasm and his endless love of heritage makes him a worthy winner of this year's award. Once you listen to my conversation with Patrick, I'm sure you will agree. Enjoy the show. Patrick Bonner, a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. How are you keeping?
Hey, Greg. It's good to be on here and good to win the award, which was totally unexpected, but it's always good to get awards.
That's really important. You are the Heritage Hero 2021. And how that's been described to me, you know, by the Heritage Council, the award is won by someone who works tirelessly to protect and promote heritage. And I know in 2021, there was like 150 nominations, people up and down the length and breadth of the island of Ireland. And there's a bunch of criteria. And I think it's important that we understand the criteria before we launch into this conversation with you. How long this person has been involved in working tirelessly to protect and promote heritage, the spread of your work around heritage, built heritage, natural, cultural, the protection and promotion of heritage, generating awareness, outreach, getting involved in groups, organizations in the locality, and that general promoting, go-to person, flag waver, social media champion, etc., etc. That's Patrick Bonner in 2021. So where are you sitting? Where are you from, Patrick?
Originally, I'm from London, as you can tell from my accent. I'm based in Donegal now, but I haven't picked up any Donegal accent. I use a few words and phrases which might come in, but it's a London. The reason I'm here, my father came from here. My father was born in a place called Crickamore, not far from where I live in Burtonport. And he met my mother, who was from Connemara. And our family grew up in West London, in Hanwell, Ealing. And we've made this place our home.
And to the listener, Patrick, who has no idea where Burtonport is, could you describe it?
Burtonport is famous for being a great fishing place in the past. It's in the west part of Donegal, opposite Ara Moor. If you go due west of Letterkenny, a straight line, you'll hit Burtonport. Now, roads in Donegal, of course, there are no straight roads in Donegal. So when I say you go straight from Letterkenny, you'll go through mountains and valleys. And you know, so it's about an hour from Letterkenny.
Am I right in saying there's a bit of history about where you're living?
Well, the house that we're living in it dates from 1895. So it's a late Victorian house. And it's got quite a varied history. It was built by a local merchant, a guy called John Sweeney, Johnny Ruhr, he's called here. And the most famous person, I guess, who was born here was Major General Joe Sweeney. And when he was very young, I think he was 19, he was in the GPO fighting in 1916. And in fact, he was such a good marksman. He was on the roof as a sniper. And he later became a TD in the first, second, and third Dáil. He became, for a brief time, the head of the overall army in Ireland, of the Free State Army, as it was called. So he, you know, is a very significant person here. In fact, in 1916, during Heritage Week, we had a special commemorative ceremony for him, and we unveiled a plaque to him on the steamer shed down in Burtonport, and we had quite a large gathering of people, family included, for Joe Sweeney. Later, from 1940, a family called the O'Donnells lived here. They lived here about 1974, and everybody likes the O'Donnells. But then when Jimmy Donnarua, James O'Donnell, died, and his widow Annie sold the house, she wasn't quite expecting who she sold it to, because she ended up selling it to a group called the Screamers. You may have heard of the Screamers. I'm sure you'd have heard of it by reputation. A woman called Jenny James set up a commune here called the Atlantis Commune. She wrote several books. One was called They Call Us the Screamers. And they were a kind of a countercultural alternative therapy group. And they did amazing things to the outside of the building. They covered it in astrological symbols. The two windows at the top were made like eyes. There was the Earth Goddess on the gable. They were quite a shock. If you can imagine 1970s West Donegal, they were quite a shock. And she's actually now, she's alive and living in Colombia now. She moved in 1987. But they caused quite a few waves here. And they were here till about the late 80s. And they then sold to another group called the Silver Sisters. So there's been a series of, it's changed now since Carrie and I bought the place. Everything's peaceful, but there was a series of alternative therapy people, the Silver Sisters, the Victorian ladies, and this all ended about in the 90s. So unusual history.
And Patrick, was that the end of the screaming and the property?
Well, there's some people, when we first got the house, people were saying, well, stones have memories. And, in certain rooms, certain things happen. But of course, that's belief. Obviously stones don't have memories and there's no such thing as haunting. I'm quite a cynic when it comes to that kind of thing. But no, it's an interesting history. The people who grew up with them, the people who are now in their 50s, who grew up with the children who are here, have very fond memories of them and they stay in touch. But there's the older generation, some of them would still be very critical of certainly what went on here. It got so bad they had to move out to one of the islands off here, Innisfree. And the HSC, or whatever the HSC was called then, was after them, and the guards are after them, and the newspapers are always on their case. And in the end, they decided, well, we'll move away. And Jenny set up another Atlantis, shall we say, in Colombia. And that was in 1987, 1988. And she's still there, still going.
From Donegal to Colombia.
Yep. Yeah, it was quite a journey. In fact, she wrote a book about it. It's not one of her published books, but she sent it to me as a PDF. So you can read it. And it's fascinating. She starts in the Canaries, I think. She ends up then going to the Caribbean, then lands in Venezuela, tries to go to Colombia. They won't let her in to stay. So she goes to Peru. Then she comes back the next year. But she's there ever since. And still practicing the same principles. Ahead of her time, really, in terms of climate and ecosystems.
And Patrick, your interest in heritage, where did all that begin? How did that itch start?
It is an itch, and we're very lucky in our family. My uncle Paki, Paki Boner, not the footballer, he'd be a bit younger than me. He was the local historian here for decades. He was a school teacher in Arranmore. He collected so many stories, songs. He was big on collecting songs. He wrote what was quite a famous book in the Gelgor community, is Rosharua. You may have heard of that, Greg. It's a very well thought of book. It's about a woman who was also known as Rosha Naaran, Rose of the Songs. She collected songs and sang herself. So as we were growing up, Paki was a great influence. And in fact, all his family, all of his children are very interested in the heritage themselves. So I would be talking to Paki and I'd be collecting things from when I was living in England. I would collect photographs or books, or I remember getting one particularly nice map for him, which was the John Speed map of the north of Ireland. That was for his 80th birthday. And really, it came from that. And I don't know what it's like where you are, Greg, but Ireland's very different to England. Heritage and history is real. When people go into a bar, yes, they'll talk about the football, they'll talk about, whatever politician is doing something awful. But it's astonishing just how much interest there is in local history. And that's because I think it's very recent. Most of the history is, Ireland is a relatively young country. If you go to a bar in a suburb of London, people aren't going to start talking about the 19th century, the 18th century. But Ireland's history is very real and recent. And, in fact, we're going through a period of commemoration at the moment. This is a period of this 10 years, and we're coming up to, we're in the War of Independence. We're coming up to, got to partition, coming up to the Civil War. This is all very real. The political parties of today were formed in that era. So, you know, it's a very different thing. So my personal connection is with my Uncle Paki, and I find it personally interesting. I find it intellectually fascinating. I love the discovery part of it. In fact, if you ask most people into local history, it's the research, it's the finding out, it's making connections between facts that don't seem like they're connected. So I think for me, I get such pleasure out of it. In fact, when I was talking to our county heritage officer, Joe Gallagher, who was reminding me of all the things that we'd done together, I always think of it as the next thing. I always think of the next project. You forget about the ones you've done and you move on because you got such pleasure out of them. You say an itch. Itch is good because I am forever trying to find out things. Some things I've been looking 15 years for and still hoping to find them. The other thing about it, it's a great way to meet people. One of the projects, this is going back some time now, I was asked by the local cooperative movement here as a commemoration for their 100th anniversary if I would write a story of the Cope, as it's called here. One of the Ross's most famous men is a guy called Paddy the Cope. And in fact, his grandson, Pat the Cope, was an MEP and was a TD for many years. Oh, you do? There's a lovely man, but does a huge amount for the area. Well, they asked me to write this book. Now, I hadn't written a book at that stage, so I had no idea how to go about it. The year of the centenary was 2006. So I think they asked me in September, October, could I put together something for the centenary? Thinking, yeah, well, that means, you know, by December, you mean? So I thought, well, okay, I'll have a go. And of course, that's impossible. I won't go through all the details, but 2.5 years later, in 2009, I managed to finish the story of the Cope. And one of the great things about that was the number of people who I never would have got to meet and the stories they told me, the photographs they gave me, the documents, some legends, some things which couldn't possibly be true, but were such great stories. So that was like an introduction. It was almost like a gateway into the local history of Dunloe in West Donegal and of Mahari and all the other places. So,
and I presume, Patrick, when you reveal those stories, often you find with those stories come people. The stories end up connecting with other stories. And before you know it, you're revealing all of the time. And in a way, you know, I hear you talking about history and that interest in it. And we can kind of think of it as a static thing, that it is what it is. But in a way, it is what we reveal. I was obviously given a list of your achievements and the different things that you've worked on. It sounds to me like you're revealing on an ongoing basis, and revealing and presenting and giving people nice ways to carry things forward as well.
Yeah, it is. And I think that one of the things I found is that, I mean, you might think that, I mean, what's this guy with this London accent coming here telling us about what we've been doing in our past? That's not how people feel about it at all. They're delighted that there's somebody actively exploring and developing and demystifying things. For example, there should have been a great commemoration here in 2014 because Patrick Pearce came in 1914 and spoke to a huge group in the local parochial hall. But we hadn't found it by then. You know, that memory had gone, and the very detailed newspaper account hadn't been found. So in the story of the Cope, I mean, I worked with some of the Cope family on it, the grandchildren. In fact, Paddy the Cope now, he's the grandson of the Paddy the Cope and Sally the Cope. He was very, very helpful. And his wife, Char, who's a Sweeney, she was incredibly helpful. And they were so supportive. And you're right. If you come in at one angle, like this is the cooperative movement, you then meet other people who've got other stories. And then they're encouraged to think, well, this story is worth telling. And people set out on their own trail. And I met a lot of, I mean, unfortunately, this is going back 12, 13 years now. Many of those people I got great stories from are no longer with us. But in fact, because I did meet them at the time and their story was recorded, or their photographs have been recorded, they're now within that book. And it was a mighty book, as I think the term would go in Kerry, is it? Mighty, mighty. It was 604 pages and 480 photographs. So there was a lot of work in it. That's why it took 2.5 years.
Again, from my notes, Patrick, I know there's a Burton Port Heritage Group, and you assume all of these things, you know, are good and organized and lots of different people, and they're there forever. Obviously, these things need to be started by someone. Were you one of the founders, or did someone knock on your door and say, listen, I know you're interested in heritage. Can you jump in with us.
Yeah, it's interesting. In fact, we're just coming up to the 10th anniversary of the Heritage Group. What happened was there was a small action group founded to try and bring Burton Port back. Because I mentioned Burton Port was famous for fishing, but unfortunately, the fishing has pretty much collapsed in the last 15, 20 years. It used to be, I think, you were more salmon landed here back in the 80s and 90s than any other port in Europe. So the action group was founded. And one of the streams that came out of that was, well, why don't we set up a heritage group? Now, myself and a few others, Breda Langan, who was very active in it, Sean Crean. There's a core of us, Peter McGuinness. We founded this group and we didn't know what to do. It's a nice idea having a group. We had a meeting and it was a very well attended meeting. There was a lot of interest in it. One of the first things we did was set up a Facebook group. Now, I know Facebook's getting a lot of flack at the moment for good reasons, but from a local history point of view, Facebook is a fantastic resource. You know, it's a great place for people to join, to share photographs, to share stories, to share documents, to share their own memories. And, you know, we started it, in fact, just last month, 10 years ago, although the first post didn't go up until January because we hadn't actually had the meeting yet. And from then on, and mainly with Breda Langan's fantastic support, we've grown now, I think, to over 2,500 members worldwide. There are people in Australia checking in, America, Scotland, big connections in West Donegal with Scotland and England. There are also, in this very small area, there are five very large Facebook groups, one for the Lower Rosses, Upper Rosses, Lesher Mac Award, Arran Moor. And the combined membership, of course, some people are in more than one group, I'm in all of them, it's probably approaching something like 15,000 people across the world. So that was a very influential thing. And then we set about organizing walks. And the very first walk we did, it was probably 2011 or 12. It was a holiday weekend here, a lot of people home from Scotland. So we said we'd have a walk from the church in Acres and down to Burton Port. And our first walk, we had no idea who would turn up. I thought, we might get 10 or 15 people. 93 people turned up for this walk. It was a great day, very sunny. And having done many of them since, 93 is pretty unmanageable. It's a traffic problem. It's a crowd control problem. And then we started the walk and we walked down to the crossroads at Burton Port. And just as we got there, and I was trying to marshal everybody, get sort of marshals to sort of block traffic to cross the road, a Honda run came up the road from, they'd been on Arran Moor. Do you have Honda runs where you are?
I don't think so.
It's like a tractor run, but basically people on Hondas. So about 150 Hondas came up the road. So I've got 93 people trying to get across this road. And then 150 Hondas came zooming around the bend. It was a bit of a nightmare. But I think if you get 20 to 30 people on a walk, is probably that's manageable.
And Patrick, with the Burton Port Heritage Group, is this a case of if you build it, they will come?
Definitely.
The fact that you begin something, you're lighting the fire on bringing people together around something a lot of us are interested in anyway. You know, your locality, the history, the habitation, and it's really just a hub to bring that to life a little bit.
That's a brilliant way of putting it, actually, because if you build it, they will come. There is a thirst out there for this kind of knowledge and interaction with people. People want to learn more about the past, and it just needs an initiative. I mean, any part of the country can do this. I mean, we're fortunate here because we've got several local groups, and you know they're always well attended. For example, our friend Bernadette Sanson, every year she runs a series of talks in a local national school, which is not used as a national school anymore. Very well attended there, and people are just—it's not a desperation; it's a keenness, and it's a real desire, a passion to learn more about the past. And more people are confident about coming to talk. I mean, as you know yourself, it's getting people in front of cameras or getting them to stand up and do talks. Most people do not want to do that. But there's such warmth and there's such a great reception to people talking about their own experiences. For example, we had a wonderful one there. I think it wasn't last year because of the COVID. The one before, we had Eugene Green, who talked to us about the lime kilns of Loch Inniu. Now, there's a great name for a book, isn't it? The Lime Kilns of Loch Inniu.
I think your next book is...
oh, that'd be huge.
You have the title, at least.
But no, it was a subject that I knew very little about. But there was I forget how many he said there were. There was well over 20 lime kilns in this village. This is a very picturesque village. It enters the tidy towns every year. It's a very beautiful place to go through. Has a wonderful lake for trout fishing and sea trout, and I'm not sure about salmon. It's a very picturesque village. You can't imagine it with, you know, piles and piles of smoke piling into the air. And Eugene did a wonderful job doing that. And Eugene is somebody who, you know, 10 years ago wouldn't be doing that sort of thing. But now he's set up his own center. Neil O'Donnell, who wrote the classic Irish-English dictionary, he was born in Lochinure. And Eugene's opened up his old house as a cultural center. And he has Irish language classes there. He has singing, dancing. Each year there's a festival of Neil O'Donnell, and people are invited. Some really distinguished speakers from Dublin came up 2 years ago. There are people who can contribute locally, and there are people who want to go to these events. So it's like you said, if you build it, they will come. Once you get them going, it needs somebody to take an initiative, whether it be Bernadette or Eugene or Charles Sweeney or whoever, and people will love to come to these events.
And of course, then when there's a group, you've got a mix of skill sets. Mm-hmm. So then when it comes to organizing a walk, doing a talk,
yeah,
organizing some initiative.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you another example, Greg. We have what's here called the Burtonport Railway Walk. We had a railway here between 1903 and 1940, and then it was closed down, which is a terrible shame, really. But it was successful to start with, and then gradually became less and less competitive and needing more investment. But because of the railway walk, we've introduced probably for the last 7 or 8 years, 9 years, heritage walks on the railway. And we've attracted, I mean, there's a guy who's written a wonderful book, or several books, about the Lough Swilly Railway, as it's called, a guy called Joe Begley, who lives in Poole in Dorset. And he regularly comes back. He was back last weekend to see us. And he has guided walks there, and other people guide walks. I used to do it myself. And having moved on to other things, the manager of the community center in Burtonport, Margaret Boner, is now guiding those walks. So that's a very popular walk, and it's a very, and we're hoping at some stage, a bit like Mayo with the Greenway, we're hoping to get a Donegal Greenway built so that it starts at Burtonport, goes all the way through past Errigal, over the Owen Carra Viaduct, and into Letterkenny. And that's we thought we might see it announced the other day. You know, there was a big spending plan about national infrastructure and stuff like that, and that would be wonderful. So there are different strands that come at it. The railway itself is a completely separate history. I'm personally not that interested in the technology of railways, you know, tank engines and however many wheels they've got. But the social history is fascinating about the railways. It really is very interesting about how it changed people's behavior. For example, if you if there was a particular thing you didn't want to confess to your local priest, you get the train up to, you know, maybe 15 miles away. You confess it in there where you weren't known, and you come back again. You know,
if you go through the door of one of the churches, Patrick, they reckon, oh my God, this fella has come a long way. He must have some whoppers of sins to tell me today.
You wouldn't get away with it today. This is too much. There's too much social media, and people travel much more here. The other thing we were out on the boat yesterday with Jim Muldowney, who does marine heritage tours and diving. One of the great things that we were doing together was heritage tours on the water. I mean, for people listening, Burtonport is port, but it's ringed by 10 islands, beautiful islands, and there's a wonderful channel between them. And there's magnificent history on them. I mean, for example, in the 1780s, a fishing station was established here. It cost something like 40,000 at the time. So if you scale it up, it's tens of millions. And the buildings from the original structure of the fishing station, including a street of 15 or 16 buildings, are still there. And it looks like a Hollywood film set. Is it? Who would build on an island like this, these magnificent buildings? So, and the great thing about doing heritage on the water is that, unlike the railway walk or a walk through the village or a walk in Dunlow or a walk on one of the many trails, the heritage comes to you. You just sit there on the boat and you talk away, and the boat passes them and you talk about them as they go. It's a very relaxing way to guide a heritage walk, is being on the water. And and if people are traveling here, staycationing is much more popular. If you're ever up this way, it's a great place to do a heritage trail from on the water.
And Patrick, the consumer, you know, the Joe Soap who ends up going on one of these walks, what'll we do today, Saturday, Sunday? What'll we do with the children out in the boat or on foot or whatever? How do these change those people, and in particular those children?
Well, we've actually done, I work with the local school here, the Rosses Community School, and one of the local teachers, and I've been helping her with a book she's doing on the heritage here. And I've been out quite a few times with the children. And, well, I guess if you're a child, you might, or these are transition year students, be about 16, 17, I think. I guess if you're not in a classroom and you're out on a boat or you're out on a trail, that's a result, as we would say in English. You know, it's better there. But I think what they do find is they get, it varies between within a group. Some children get very, very interested and actually start researching themselves, their own family. And they ask their parents and their grandparents, which is great because that's always encouraged, you know, in the schools to, it gives them a kind of an entry into a past that they wouldn't ordinarily come across. And Joanne in particular, she's very good at exciting the imaginations of the children, and her book, when it's be published shortly. For people who are not from the area, they're always fascinated by it because they see the buildings and they think, what's that? Is that a castle? Is that, oh, it's a Coast Guard station. Oh, and what, and that, what's that? Their experience is enriched. I mean, they love coming here for the scenery. They love coming here for the empty strands, you know, or beaches, as we call them in England. You won't get, it's not going to be like Bundoran or the busy beaches on the east coast of Ireland, but they get to learn a bit more about the place and its history. I think people feel enriched is too grand a word, but they feel that they've the experience, they get more of an experience of understanding a place when they've learned about its history, I think.
Yeah, that building becomes a different thing when I know what it was used for, and that place becomes a different place when I know all of those stories that attach to it. So your connection to it becomes a little bit deeper and enriched, to use your fantastic word. The different initiatives, Patrick, down through the years, and again, I was given this colossal shopping list of things, like some of the ones you mentioned. Are there some other initiatives there that are close to your heart, things that you really enjoyed, and you might tell me what they were and why?
I think, well, there's one which is taking a bit too long, really. Myself and a few other people, including a guy called Hugh Gerard Boyle over in Mahari, have been trying to get the conservation work done on the local church here in Temple Crone Church. And it's one of those places that once it has been conserved and it's safe to go in there without breaking gravestones and the fabric of the building. And it's the fabric of the building dates back to around about the year 1200. It will be one of those places that will be that everybody will want to visit. But these projects, I mean, we've worked with the Heritage Council probably over, I'd say something like 8 years, and got many grants from them to get various bits repaired. But we're now at a point where we need to get to serious money, shall we say. We need to go to, I don't know, LEADER or some other group or community fund, because it's at the point now where you need to sort of preserve the fabric of the grave stones, the grave markers, create access, get signage, get car parking, make it something that's visitable. So that would be a great satisfaction to have moved it onto that stage. So myself and Hugh Gerard over the winter will be working on the basis of that. So that would be wonderful to do. In terms of personal, what do I personally enjoy on a day-to-day? I love the heritage trips with Jim Muldowney. They were fantastic. We went three times to Roan Inish, which is an island which is south of here. It's not part of the Rosses technically, but wonderful trip. I've never seen as many seabirds in the one place at the one time. It was astonishing. And the local fishermen here used to, in the summer, they used to live on Roan Inish over the summer. They'd be fishing for lobsters, for example. So during the week, they would fish there. And they would live in these stone huts, which have got a tantalizing look about them. You get a sense that they might be a lot older than just stone huts in the 40s and 50s. And the stone huts are still there, and it's a magical place. So I always like visiting islands. And learning about the island. We've got Arramore, which is our biggest island. In fact, one interesting fact, 200 years ago was the first national census of Ireland in 1821. And at that stage, Dunloe, which is the big town here now, hadn't been long established. It had been established about 60 years. And there were six times as many people living on the islands as there were living in Dunloe. And, you know, Arramore had 788 people living. And today Arranmore would have between 400 and 450 people. And it is one of the few occupied islands. I mean, Tory Island's another. There's Tory and Arranmore are the main occupied islands. All the other ones have been, the people have left. So when you go to visit Inishree now, or Inishcoo, Icta, all these smaller islands, which had populations well over 100, 150 in some cases, they're deserted now. You get people there with holiday homes. There'll be cattle on the islands. And a couple of them have got some really nasty-looking bulls you've got to be careful of. But it's quite a transformation. And even that story itself, and I was coming back through Dunloe today, and it's very hard to explain to people that there was a point where Dunloe just didn't exist. You know, just it's got such a physicality now. There's a great line in, it's Ulysses. When Joyce gives it to Stephen Dedalus, he's walking along the Sandy Mount Strand, and he uses the term, the ineluctable modality of the visible. Which when I first read it, I needed a dictionary for. Basically, it means it's there. You can't mistake the fact that it's there. You know, there's buildings there. They must have been there all the time. But if you go back to, say, 1760, there was nothing there. And all the action, all the population, all of the culture was on the islands. I find that fascinating, how that transformation. And I'm still researching it. And it's an endless fascination to research and to understand how the place has changed.
And tell me, does Carrie get dragged on all these expeditions, does she?
Now that's interesting. I was talking about this yesterday. She's less enthused by the whole thing. In fact, one of the things she's most enthused about is I'm at the moment going through everything I've been collecting for the last 30 odd years or more, and I'm putting it into our archives, our local archives in Lifford. Now, I've got great enjoyment from the maps I've collected and the documents and the photographs. And I've now decided, well, the best thing now is to give them all to the local county archive. Digitize them as much as possible, catalogue them so that people know what they're getting. And then it means that other people, schools, researchers, individuals, people writing books, can actually go to the archives and use the same material. Now, she's delighted about this project. Because it, in her mind, it's decluttering. So there's no problem at all about that project. The book I mentioned earlier, the one about the coat, I put a little note inside the book, in the hardback version of it. And I said, it says, Patrick's wife, Carrie, says that he's not allowed to call this his first book. It was such torture. That's a local word, torture. Such a torture doing it. She doesn't want me to do a second one.
Yeah, it's referred to your only book.
Yes, that's it. That was her preference. But no, she's very supportive. She understands the interest I have in it. And in fact, she reads herself on stuff, and she's a great reader. And in fact, she reads far more than I do, but not necessarily about local history.
I'm getting the small impression, Patrick, that itch is still there.
It definitely is. Yeah. I've got a project right now which is 10 years late. I promised the Cope family, that's the descendants of Paddy the Cope and Sally the Cope, that I would actually publish Sally's stories. When I was doing the Cope research, I found in Limerick, which is a long way from here, that the typescripts of stories that Paddy the Cope's wife wrote back in the 1940s. And it turned out that he didn't know that she was writing them. She died in 1948. And when he was going through her papers and stuff, in a box at the bottom of a dresser, there were these fantastic stories, which were the story of their meeting, the story of their founding the cooperative movement here, but from her take. So I said to them, don't worry. I was on a roll. I'll publish them next year. That was 2010 or 11. So here we are. They're going to be published this month. So I've got to get that over with now. I worked out at one stage that there's probably 37 books to be written that I could help with here. But obviously, you're not going to do all those. So you've got to be selective. There's a book on Temple Crone to support the conservation. There's Sally the Cope's book, which is coming out this month. And what I have been trying to do, and I don't know if it's come across in what I've been saying earlier, but you don't have to do it all yourself. There's so much to do. There's so much to find out about the past and to research, to connect different strands, that I always try to help other people do, you know, to do their work. One of the islands I mentioned, Inishcoo, a man called Martin Shepherd contacted me in about 6 years ago, and he was looking for his ancestors, and he was trying to find a place called Inishcoo. And of course, Inishkoo is one of the islands off here. And it turned out that he had discovered letters in Sligo, in Temple House in Sligo, which were written between his, I don't know how many, great-great-great-great-great-grandmother and grandfather. She was a governess on the island. And he was a ship's captain from Yarmouth in Norfolk. And in the summer of 1787, he was there for 5 weeks. They fell in love, and then they wrote letters to each other. So she was writing from this little tiny island in Donegal. And some of them, the postmarks are fantastic on them. One goes from Rutland, which is the name of the center of the fishing station. And it's going to a place called Courland, which took a bit of finding out. It's Latvia. So these letters are going all over Europe. And sometimes they get to him, and sometimes he'd be stranded. But what I suggested to Martin once we started talking about it is, Martin, this would make a fantastic story. It is a fantastic story. And Martin said, "Oh, do you think so? Do you think, what about, would you help me sort of do the background research on it? Because the letters stand on their own." So Martin produced this book. He launched it 3 years ago now. And as part of that, he was getting other stories about Inishkoo. And some people said it was an old house, a plantation house, maybe from 1610, 1620. And I knew for certain that it wasn't. And I knew that there was some surveyor's drawings, which somebody locally, in fact, in Tyrone had, but he wouldn't let me copy them and he would sell them. So I thought, well, I then asked people on the island and people who are interested in heritage here, and we crowdfunded. We raised £2,000 sterling. You know, it's a lot of money for an individual, but we all put in about, I think, €150 each. And we bought these wonderful drawings, originals. There's nothing like them. And they show what the islands were like before the fishing station was developed and the local people lived on them. And right where Inishkoo House was in 1784, nothing. So it proved beyond any doubt that Inishkoo House was part of the fishing development and it was the headquarters. So that's an example of how a man who's looking for his ancestors finds letters in Sligo, contacts us here, finds out where Inishkoo is persuaded, encouraged, would make a great book, Martin. He writes the book. Because the book has got to be factual and not full of mythology, we researched it. We then went out and crowdfunded the maps. And then at the end of it, we got them digitized. In fact, a friend is in Coleraine University, West Forsyth, digitized them. And then we donated them. Having bought them, we donated them to the County Archive. So the County Archive is the end beneficiary here. And when I think of the archive, I think, well, that means that everybody in the county is a beneficiary, the school children, the researchers.
So, Patrick, for anyone out there who has experienced this itch, would you have any advice as to how to get involved, how to scratch this itch, relieve it a little bit?
Well, find someone with a similar itch is a good start. I would have thought that most areas have a local group. I mean, it's hard to think of an area that doesn't have any local history group. I mentioned Facebook. Facebook is a great place to find. You can search by place name. You can search by family name. We're fortunate here because we have so many of them. It's possible there are parts of the country where it's not as frequently used. But I would say that it wouldn't take much. If you read the local newspapers or look in local bookshops or go to local heritage centres, there's about to be one, within 10 miles, 20 miles. And just connect with other people who've got the same itch and see what cream they use.
Patrick Bonner, Heritage Hero 2021. Thanks a million for coming on the Heritage Council podcast, and we'll talk to you again sometime.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Greg. I've really enjoyed it. The people who nominated me, and it's wonderful. I'm a big surprise. Big surprise.
Well done.
Okay. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others, and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.